Hello and welcome to the CFO Playbook podcast. My name's David McClelland. I'm a journalist and broadcaster. I cover business, technology and leadership. And here on the CFO Playbook, I get under the skin of how world-class finance leaders from across various industries leverage technology as well as set goals, make plans, manage teams and much, much more. And in today's episode, we speak with a CFO from one of Europe's largest financial services groups about the role of legal, compliance, and risk management in a modern CFO's work, as well as empowering teams to be productive.
You want senior managers in your team who are what I would call listenable. And by that, I mean who can put out relatable, concrete, actionable advice to your clients, which does not stop with numbers, but rather extends to matters of risk, strategy, business judgment, and most important of all, growth. If you pair that with the ability to make complicated financial terms explainable to also the non-financial literate quarter in your firm, I think everybody will thank you. If all of this is in place, I think a CFO can act as a true co-pilot to the CEO in the actual sense, and by that I mean the one who's actually flying and operating the plane 90% of the time. And in my book, that's what you should be doing and enjoying as a CFO.
And a reminder that the CFO Playbook is here every month with exclusive interviews and insights from world-class finance leaders. So please do tap on that subscribe button and why not have a listen through our extensive back catalogue. We are a stone's throw away from 100 episodes now, can you believe? And look, don't be afraid to get in touch, as many of you do. Your suggestions really do help to shape our output. So let us know who or what you'd like us to speak to in our upcoming shows. Right. On with today's show.
This episode of the CFO Playbook is brought to you by Soldo. Trusted by over 25,000 organizations across 31 countries, Soldo combines pre-programmed cards, an intuitive app, and a powerful management platform to replace manual processes with efficiency and control. To find out more or to book a demo, visit soldo.com.
Thomas Schindler, CFO at Allianz Global Investors. Thank you for joining us on the CFO Playbook.
Thank you, David, for having me. It's a great pleasure to be on your podcast today.
Thank you so much for joining us. Whereabouts are you calling in from?
Munich, that is.
Oh, Munich. And tell me, what's the weather like at this time of year in Munich?
It's very cold.
Not too different from here in the UK, I must say. But great to have you with us. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I know that you've listened to the podcast in the past as well. Now, Allianz is a brand with a high degree of recognition. Many will know it for its insurance products. And I read that it is the world's largest insurance company. But it is also among the largest financial services groups in Europe, too. So, Thomas, before we come specifically onto your role there, how do you describe what Allianz Global Investors does and how it fits into that bigger Allianz picture?
We are an asset management firm operating globally. We are present in more than 20 countries, and there's more than 2,500 people working in our firm. And we manage a bit more than 550, 560 billion euro of assets, which is client money. Partly for Allianz, partly for our clients. And I think asset management as an industry, at least in Europe, is probably not as well known as insurance or banking or other parts of the financial services industry. And by the way, the same goes for me. When I applied with Allianz almost 20 years ago, I had no idea about this world of asset management. I didn't even know it existed. So what is it we do? Put simply, we pool client money in mutual funds or segregated accounts, and then our portfolio managers invest that client money either in the liquid space, which is in the stock market by investing it into equities or fixed income, or in the private market space, for example, into infrastructure or renewable energy projects. In doing so, we help our clients achieve their financial objectives, whatever they may be. And as an industry, I think, quite frankly, we are awesome because for clients, we help them to harvest returns, for example, to provide for their retirement. For the public sector, it matters since we are one of the key levers to enable long-term financing, long-term investments, for example, into infrastructure, which the public sector in some instances could otherwise not provide. For Allianz, as our corporate parents, is super interesting to own an asset manager too, because we not only manage their assets, we are, compared to a bank, fairly capital light. We do not consume a lot of capital. We distribute cash imminently, and even though we are heavily regulated, our business model is actually quite simple. We receive a fee from clients in exchange for running their money. Maybe one last personal remark, because I've been in this industry for almost 20 years, and I still believe asset management is a gem. It's awesome, because our firm, like many others out there in the industry, we are very international. We hire top qualified people, and I'd say culturally, if you think of a spectrum, like more traditional financial services firms like insurance on one end of the spectrum, and then let's say investment banking on the other end of the spectrum, we are right in the middle on that continuum. We kind of bring to the table the best of both worlds, and that goes a long way in my book.
Good to hear asset management being described as awesome there. And you mentioned some big numbers, 2,500 people, more than 550 billion euro assets under management there. So clearly it's a very sizable operation that you have. And let's come on to your role there, because, you know, we hear on the CFO playbook all the time about the CFO role and about how its responsibilities can really vary from one business to another business. You've explained your business at Allianz Global Investors. So what does being CFO look like for you there? What's in your hat? What's in your portfolio there?
Yeah, I'd say my current remit is quite broad for a CFO. I run a team of about 350 people across the globe, covering not only finance, but also legal, compliance, risk management. In other words, all governance functions. So sometimes we joke and say there is no single problem within our firm which you cannot trace directly or indirectly to me, because it may not be a legal problem, it may not be a compliance problem, it may not be a risk problem, but at a minimum, it's gotta have some financial impact. And even though I'm just joking, I think this is a blessing and a privilege, because it does make sure we as a function, and at the same time, myself as a CFO, we have a seat at the table at all times.
Legal, compliance, risk management in there. Let's lean into that, specifically into the legal, I think, for a moment, because something that we haven't mentioned yet is that your route into being CFO, it wasn't the, I'll use big rabbit's ears here, traditional finance path. Instead, you trained as a lawyer. You have a master's degree from Oxford. You have a PhD in law from the University of Regensburg. So what can you tell us about that first part of your journey in the legal space, and then how your path crossed over into the finance leadership position you find yourself in now?
Yeah, David, you're right. I'm a lawyer by education. And I'd say as a lawyer, I collected all the usual feathers in the head earlier in my career. So I would kind of describe the first part of my journey as learning my craft as a lawyer, first in private practice at a law firm and then at Allianz Global Investors. And I very much enjoyed that. But I also realized it's a little bit like what a driving instructor is to an 18-year-old. You're one of the most important persons, but only for a 4 or 6 week time span. So that's a little bit what being a lawyer is. So I had a strong desire to branch out. So I guess the second part of my journey, I would call branching out, becoming relevant outside my bubble. And fortunately, I was given the opportunity to run the CEO and the CFO office for 5 years. And that was kind of a mixture between, you know, Magic Mountain and Wonderland, because I could immerse myself in almost an infinite number of projects, topics to my liking: executive compensation, crisis management, financial steering, M&A transactions, corporate communications. And only years later, I would understand what I learned there, which was effectively problem solving, communication, honing your business judgment, which was super, super helpful, because on that basis, I really wanted to become a manager of significant teams, building my portfolio, which is kind of the third step. But truth being told, what I did want to become was a chief operating officer, which failed. I couldn't land a job as a COO, so I had to come back to become a general counsel, which I at the time perceived as a big failure.
Interesting. So there was a conscious move towards being the COO, but for whatever reason, maybe we'll touch on that in a moment, that didn't work out. But the CFO route opened up for you. Given your background in legal counsel, all of your training and the early part of your career's experience, what has that enabled you to bring with you? You know, if we talk about superpowers, if we talk about where you see your strengths as being, maybe where others reflect on your strengths as being, is there a thing that you really still wear from that first part of your career that you're able to wear and use now?
Yeah, I think just to close that off, when I started as general counsel, it literally took me just a couple of months to understand that the job I took on was not so much different from the CEO office. Because if you run a team of, let's say, 100 people, you understand very quickly this is all about problem solving, about setting strategy, about mapping out the direction going forward. So it really wasn't that big of a thing. And within a couple of months, I understood that this is actually a great opportunity. So after the initial disappointment, I actually built on that and kept adding to the portfolio. So I became general counsel globally, then added risk, transformed risk. And the last step to building that portfolio was to then tap into finance, which now complemented the portfolio in a sense, since I'm the bracket between all governance and control functions. So looking back, actually, it was super helpful, because after a couple of months, I understood it's actually just a management role like any other.
I joked a moment ago about traditional routes into becoming CFO. And of course, that there are some traditional routes. A good number of the guests that we've spoken to on this show actually haven't come primarily from an accountancy or financial background. It was just over a year or so ago that you made that switch to CFO. And like you say, this kind of bracket with the other responsibilities that you have. What did that transition mean for you? How did those around you ensure that you were comfortable with that switch? Was there a gap, or actually had you already had pretty good oversight about what was on the other side of that gap?
Yeah, funny enough, in some ways, the taking on of the role as CFO was not so much different from the taking on of other jobs early in my career, where you're trying to understand what's going on. You talk to many, many people. You take charge of the team in order to figure out what you want to change. Then you map out your actual strategy. Now, obviously, with finance, this was a little different, because even though I had picked up quite a bit on things like financial steering, running the CEO office, I obviously have never been and will never be an accountant. So there's a few things I just had to do. One was put in the extra effort. During the first period, there was a ton of early morning reading and late night reading. And second, I also got a little extra help in training from accounting and consulting firms as part of my onboarding journey, which was tremendously helpful. But once this was done, I think I eased into the role fairly quickly, I would say.
Just over a year or so in now, is there anything that surprised you about the role? Like you say, you, with the work that you put in and the support that you had, you were able to hit the ground running. But after that first 12, 15 or so months, is there anything that you've realized that maybe you didn't realize before you stepped into it?
I think one of the things I did not see coming is as a CFO, you're almost like a mini COO, because the whole finance function is such a large element of an operational backbone on the system side. That, you know, it's a bit of a sick irony. I now get to be a mini COO, which I had aspired to earlier in my career. And there's this whole subculture of systems and so on, which I knew nothing about. But you really have to get dialed into that space too.
And what about your collaboration with the other senior leaders there? You know, we talk about the role of the CFO being a co-pilot, lots of other metaphors there. Has that collaboration, has that partnership with the COO, with the CEO, has that yielded any surprises for you, or has that been exactly as you kind of anticipated it would be?
I feel like as a CFO in my remit, I'm in an extremely privileged position because, as I said earlier, it's pretty much impossible that a significant matter arises where we have no touch point whatsoever with what I get paid to do. So that's a great starting proposition. And I think that's a basis to build on and to leverage more greatly if you use it wisely.
Legal compliance, risk management, the CFO role that you've taken on there, you've got some diverse responsibilities. How do you bring that all together into a coherent function? Can you bring it all together, or is it a case of time sharing, compartmentalizing them, managing them somewhat separately?
I think it's a bit of a mix. I have a very strong team working for me. I have a chief risk officer. I have a global head of legal. I have a global head of compliance working for me. And they know their craft. They know very well how to run their ship. So I'm kind of distributing my time as demands of the business require. So I would not necessarily speak about a coherent function. But bringing all governance function under the remit of a CFO is, for me, a perfect match because there are many areas where we have commonality in purpose and commonality in alignment. So what do I mean by that? For example, we very often look at the same set of issues, if you think about operational risk, if you think about compliance, accounting, just from different angles. Also, these functions can be quite system heavy, which is why we implemented a common and global operational backbone to all governance functions. And lastly, and I think that's probably the most important part, as I said earlier, we fortunately always have a seat at the table, which is great. So if we as a function say no, it's practically impossible for the firm to move forward regardless. The flip side is, you need to use it wisely because it's easy to say no, but to do so all the time would fall short in several really important respects. One, you lose credibility real quick. Second, what you actually want is you want to be helpful in finding ways for your firm to grow the business. So the better you are at this, the better it's going to be for everyone. And that's, for me, the ultimate yardstick.
It's all too easy to be seen as the team, as the function that says no all of the time. But to be seen and to be able to be that enabler is really what we want. You know, it's not just being a cost center or whatever. It's actually being an enabler of the business and helping to set those strategic decisions as well, based upon the visibility that you have across the organization. With regards to the risk side there, have things changed in the time that you've had risk and compliance under your remit there? Have you found that the nature of the risks that a business like Allianz GI have changed substantially? Obviously, it's a changing world, a changing operating environment that we find ourselves in now. Has that substantially changed the nature of how you have to run your role to accommodate those changing risks?
I think it's a really interesting question because, to me, one of the most complicated tasks is if you want to elevate what a risk or compliance function actually does beyond just the record keeping and the keeping systems up to date and the reporting part. That's the part you need to get right in the first place. That goes without saying. But you want to elevate the experience also with the business to a level where people can see eye to eye with the investors about appropriately assessing risks. And for that, you need incredibly good people. And that's why the cross-functional collaboration is key. Like I said earlier, we look at the same set of problems from different angles. If compliance can chip in on that, if risk can chip on that, the overall debate is way more fruitful as opposed to looking at it just in silos.
Some really interesting insights there, Thomas, particularly on the convergence of those roles, about looking at them holistically there. I'd like to continue on that theme, particularly with regards to collaboration and productivity. You are a busy leader, lots of responsibilities, not only to your company, but also to the teams that you lead. And I'd like to explore your approaches to leadership and enabling productivity with those teams in just a moment. But first, Soldo has just undertaken some research with CensusWide, taking views from senior leaders, finance leaders, and employees, which has resulted in the Productivity at Work report. I've got some quick headlines from that. 71% of finance teams and 73% of senior leaders there say that financial processes slow down or prevent them from helping employees pursue new business opportunities. So financial processes slowing things down and finding new opportunities. 40% of employees believe that productivity would increase with easier access to company money, and 36%, so over a third of senior leaders agreed with that. There's some really interesting findings and insight in that report, and there will be a link to the report in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Thomas, back to you on productivity there for a moment, though. As leaders, you have a responsibility for setting the vision and the strategy and making the big decisions and so on. But you also have a responsibility to those that you lead, to your teams, about enabling them, empowering them so that they can perform effectively and productively. What is your approach, therefore, to empowering your colleagues and your teams to be productive, to have autonomy and agility to act without you always having to be right at the heart of it all?
Look, David, it may sound odd, but whenever I take on a new job, I set myself the target to make myself redundant or at least replaceable within a 3 or 4 year time frame, which sounds initially kind of counterintuitive, but let me explain. So when you come in, you first want to understand what needs to be fixed during, let's say, the first 3-6 months, then there's a period where you really go deep, where you listen, you learn, you take in various viewpoints when you are incredibly granular. But after that, you want to execute on anything you would like to change on that basis. So you work with what I would call the avant-garde of people, the change agents, a small team of leaders who 100% understand the direction of travel and drive the change and the communication around it. And after 12 or 18 months, you repeat, you take stock of what worked well and not so well, and you execute on the second wave of changes. And that's a process which is usually concluded after 2 or 3 years, at which point you should have gotten in 2 waves of hires and placements of people in your ecosystem who operate exactly the way you would want them to. This means that I kind of make myself replaceable. And at that stage, you can fully delegate and run a highly levered team. Now, this approach has served me extremely well in the past and has several benefits. One, it forces you to bring in the smartest people, and there's many, many people in my team who are infinitely smarter and better than me, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And after the initial stock-taking period, which I described, you delegate to them and you get out of their way. This is fun for them, it's great for productivity, and it's even greater for me because organizations change over 3, 4, 5 years, so you want to be able to respond to that. You want to be able to take on new challenges, you want to be able to transform, but I can only do that if I have capacity, if I have latitude. Which is why I bring in people who have in the meantime taken on what I was originally hired to go to. For me, this is the optimal model, and it served me very, very well in the past from a productivity, thriving, and development perspective.
Lots to take away from that. And for someone who looks to make themselves redundant in 3 to 4 years, you've done very well at being at Allianz for more than 20 or so years now. But that speaks to the kind of refresh we all need to reinvent as we grow in an organization that's growing and changing as well. That opportunity to refocus, move into different areas at that kind of time periods is helpful. And also, you're also developing your own succession plan, or certainly developing the talent alongside you and beneath you in an org chart. You're helping others to develop. That enables continuity for the organization as well.
Absolutely.
Now, I should say, with this next question that I want to go into, I'm not talking for Allianz GI, and you don't have to either, Thomas. But in my experience of working for several large organizations, naming no names, of course, on occasions, process has sometimes got in the way of productivity. And whether that's, you know, too much process or process is no longer fit for purpose, you know, the kind of things that I mean. So my question for you, Thomas, is while recognizing all of the reasons that processes are important, particularly in regulated industries, I suppose, how do you make sure that processes remain fit for purpose? Don't slow teams, don't slow decisions down.
No, I think what you outlined is pretty much universally true for any large organization. And I think that's part of the eternal challenge, fighting bureaucracy. And this is particularly true, as you say, in a heavily regulated industry like ours, because let's face it, non-compliance is not an option. So I'm a vehement believer in continuous improvement. And the only way to fix this is to bring in people who are absolutely relentless and almost religious about the fact that it's never good enough where you are. So where most organizations fail is, I think you bring in two people and they create work for three because, you know, they want to establish themselves, they want to prove themselves without asking, how does it actually make our product, our output better for our clients? Now, you can only root this out by bringing in people who keep asking those uncomfortable questions, such as, what are we going to do with this information? How is it making us better for what we get paid to do? Or is it just collecting information for the sake of collecting information, which is something governance functions are very often guilty of? I also very much like the second part of your questions about modernizing processes. So let's say, okay, we accept there is a bedrock of stuff which you just need to get done, like in any franchise. I think then the attitude must be, okay, let's make sure we are the best and the most efficient ones knocking all of this out.
And that comes down to, like you say, the people that you have on board, you know, curious people, people who do want to keep on asking, why are we doing it like this? Why are we doing like this? There's also, as a leader, is there, well, you tell me, but I suspect there's an element of culture that you create as well. And as leaders, we talk a lot about creating the culture that we want for our organization, where people show up and feel to show up as their authentic selves and all of that. But in terms of creating that culture where rules, where processes can be challenged, that's something that isn't just down to the people that you hire, it's down to the tone that you set as a leader as well, isn't it?
Yes, 100%. I think the true cost is felt in bad decision-making. I mean, there's always value to applying processes, but in a strongly functionalized world, really bad business decisions get made when everybody's just responding to their individual remit and saying, yeah, you know, it doesn't sound like a great idea, but I'm actually not against it. So you aggregate many yeses on the basis of, this is not such a great idea, but I'm not going to say no. That leads to really bad business decisions. So you almost need that cohesiveness and interchange and the exchange between functions. Effectively, somebody asking common sense questions, okay, I hear that, but does it really make sense? And that's the hardest part, I feel.
Yeah, it's like listening as well. We can all get into a sense of sitting back and just listening as someone's talking at us, but the act I literally just leant forward, it's that active listening bit, that active participation in decision making, rather than just letting the decisions and the processes wash over you. Really good, thank you for that. I want to switch slightly onto collaboration now, and finance as a function. It's often been siloed in organizations, hasn't it? And I think we are now beginning to see that change. So I wonder if there's an initiative or a program or an intervention that you've seen that's been particularly effective in fostering that collaboration between finance and the larger organization.
Yeah, you know, as a general backdrop, I feel like as a CFO with my broad remit, I'm in an extremely privileged position. You have many, many opportunities to communicate with your stakeholders. You have quarterly earnings calls, you have town halls, you have open forums, you have fireside chats. So that's a great basis to build on. And on top of that, as a finance function, in recent years, we really, really doubled down on a wide range of initiatives covering and improving connectivity, such as we run Ask Me Anything sessions. We run many, many strategy sessions. We doubled down on the business partnering aspect, just to give a few examples. So once people understand, you put out relatable, specific advice, collaboration will take care of itself.
I hear in some places it's also about having those champions. It's about, yes, having your teams, keeping the door open, having those Ask Me Anything sessions and so on is one thing, but also an element of identifying champions in other teams who get the importance of that collaboration with a finance team for a moment, and kind of working with those champions in those other teams and using them as a kind of bridge, even when you can't be there, back into yourselves.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And look, I think everybody's got their respective sweet spot. I think with my background, I probably have a sweet spot at simplifying matters, at strategic questions, at senior management communication. But I have hardwired specialists in my team. And sometimes we have a good laugh when my finance guys think they can't deliver to me just yet for a few more hours a day, because what they call it is they need to do the quality assurance. That's what they call it, because the quality assurance isn't there. Now, obviously, this is super important for any finance function, because without quality assurance, there will be chaos. The numbers must be right. But for me, the early draft does it. I'm more interested in the big picture. I mean, I'm more interested in the strategic part, the senior management communication part, the assessment, the storytelling part. And that goes a long way to explain that you really need a mix of people and to ensure that level of connectedness.
Performance is important in a high responsibility role, but to perform at your best, Thomas, you must also consider your balance and your well-being. So I wonder if you have any strategies that you've found particularly beneficial for you, for your well-being, and to make sure that you're able to function at your best, not only with your colleagues in the workplace, but also in the outside world as a human as well.
Yeah, David, you know, with me, the thing is, I love to work, and I love to work a lot. And so work's always been part of my journey, and this is likely never going to change. It may sound corny, but over the years, I felt more and more at ease just bring my own authentic self to work. And that's made things easier in so many ways. At the same time, I'm a very simple person. For me, it's like work, family, and sports to recover. And maybe as an aside, I think what's worked particularly well for me and my family was every, let's say, one and a half years, we engage in an exercise of stock taking of what's worked well, what's worked not so well. And that was always very beneficial, that because we realize and we focus on the areas where we feel we need to recalibrate to keep the balance and to make sure nobody takes harm. And I think that's turned out to be really, really, really useful over the years. But, you know, that's just me. So we got to be careful. What works for me may not work for others, particularly in my team and other teams in the franchise as a whole. So I think in general, organizations should provide for options. So, you know, our people have flexibility during their tenure, and that is something we invested in heavily, which we do, I think, quite well. Still, as a caveat, I would say what most people forget is several things. I guess your life pretty much fundamentally changes every 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So work-life balance may mean something completely different to you in your 30s versus your 40s versus your 50s. So we need to adjust accordingly. Second, I think, you know, my 2 cents would be, do not make short-term judgments. I move between roles every 3 to 5 years, and I found it quite nonsensical to ask yourself, you know, questions around work-life balance in periods of change, particularly during the first, let's say, 12 months of taking on a new role, where effectively you just, you know, have to feel it out and grind it out and then take stock. But so it's a bit of a mix. It's quite a broad spectrum of things to bear in mind.
Yes, work, family, sport to recover. I won't say if the sport is to recover from the family or from the work, but I will ask about the sport. Is there any particular sport that you find yourself enjoying as a participant or as a spectator?
It varies. I've been pretty dived into cycling, which I discovered 7 or 8 years ago. So I enjoyed that quite a bit. But like many others, I completely lost the plot during COVID. So now it's more, you know, keeping myself into reasonably good shape and fighting aging decay.
A point that you made there as well around having those check-ins. And I reflect back on my entry into the working world, and I'm of a vintage when we were sent away. I worked for a big IT firm with three letters in their name, and for one of our first weeks they sent us away on a residential to learn all sorts of skills that the company thought would be helpful for us in our working life. But I remember one session in there where the chap said, ask yourself, how's it going? Every day, every week, just check in with yourself. How's it going? And be honest with yourself. And if that's the best piece of advice I can give you, he said, then so be it. But remember that, because you will find it useful in your life. And actually, I think that echoes what you're talking about there, about having those checkpoints where you do take a step back and ask yourself, how's it actually going? And being honest with yourself, it gives you that bit of space, that opportunity. And sometimes you might need somebody else to ask you that question. But as long as you have that fairly regularly, I think it's a helpful intervention. As for yourself, you recognize the same is true, not only for how you manage your own work-life balance, but that of your workforce as well. You mentioned flexibility is something that you offer there to your colleagues. How do you set a positive example? You know, we've spoken about culture and about how culture comes from the leadership there. When it comes to those examples of work-life balance, I've seen many, many leaders who, because of the role that they're given, are very, very busy, are always making themselves available. And while they may feel that is the right thing for them to do in the role, it's also setting a tone and setting an example for the rest of the workforce that might not universally be a helpful one. So what's your approach to setting that balance, that well-being tone?
So I think we really have to be careful with overgeneralizing. And I think as a manager, the most important thing you can do is figure out where people have their sweet spot. There's nothing more toxic than people applying themselves in a space where they're either unhappy or out of their depth. So first and foremost, you gotta figure out, are people writing their tweets? Are they good at what they do? Can they reasonably enjoy it? And if not, you need to call it out. Otherwise, there's simply no point in, you're not even getting to the point of on the topic of well-being. So that needs to be sorted out first. Then there's obviously a wide range of things which you can offer to people depending on what works for them. For me, and that's just my personal view, one of the most fruitful discussions you could have is make people understand you care about them as individuals. And what I mean by that is I've seen many people come and go. We've hired hundreds of people. We laid off hundreds of people. But the thing I care about most fundamentally is people in my world. I want to empower them to be in a position to lead a good and meaningful and rewarding life, be it in this firm or somewhere else. So once people understand this is your mindset, the whole topic of well-being, I think, gets a completely different dimension.
It comes down to taking time to know the people who you're working with. You know, one definition of the role of a manager is that you are managing individuals, like you say. And if you are using one approach to manage an entire team, which is made up of many different types of individuals, then there are some real challenges with that. So it's refreshing to hear that, you know, caring for individuals and trying to understand them and help them as individuals as well. Thomas, at the end of each of our conversations here on the CFO Playbook, we do like to ask a final question. We call it our showstopper question here. And well, for this year, we're asking our guests to give us their reflection on a phrase, which is progressive finance. Bit of a different one to one we've used in the past, but that's what we're going with for this year. So Thomas, what does progressive finance mean to you?
So, progressive finance means for me put in place and empower teams which display the following traits. First, you want to get the technical expertise part right. This goes without saying, if that's not there, you have nothing to work with in the first place. But on top of that, you want senior managers in your team who are what I would call listenable. And by that, I mean who can put out relatable, concrete, actionable advice to your clients, which does not stop with numbers, but rather extends to matters of risk, strategy, business judgment, and most important of all, growth. If you pair that with the ability to make complicated financial terms explainable to also the non-financial literate cohort in your firm, I think everybody will thank you. If all of this is in place, I think a CFO can act as a true co-pilot to the CEO in the actual sense. And by that, I mean the one who's actually flying and operating the plane 90% of the time. And in my book, that's what you should be doing and enjoying as a CFO.
Thank you for that well-considered answer there. Lots to think on there. That is all the time that we have for today, though. Thomas Schindler, thank you for joining us on CFO Playbook.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.